Hi, everybody. I'm Taylor Onion, and you're listening to The Bloom Pod, the show where we use the power of storytelling to share the insights of entrepreneurs, educators, and sports professionals who are chasing big dreams. We spend time asking guests about the experiences they've had that have helped them bloom into who they are today. This week's guest is an author, a proponent of higher education, and the founder of the Extra Points newsletter. Please enjoy our conversation with Matt Brown. All right. Matt, first of all, I have to say this is we're knocking off the dust here. We left off in the middle of season four back in April. I think it was April of 2022. So we're coming back almost a year later now. And you were a part of my Twitter search for entrepreneurs to help kind of round out the guests for season four. So I'm super excited to have you on. I followed your work and kind of who you are for a while now. I've been kind of following from afar with Extra Points and D1 Ticker and some of the other things that you've been doing. So I'm excited to get into our discussion today. And I'm going to start by having you share a little bit about your background. I was checking out your LinkedIn, and I'm seeing, like most of our guests, you've had a lot of different stops in your career. So give us the 2 minute rundown of the Matt Brown experience.
Sure. I'll do my best. It's a pleasure to be here. I like doing these kind of things because I fell into this business almost by accident, which is not, I think, super uncommon for people to end up starting businesses, which may be of small comfort to anybody who isn't sure exactly what it is that they want to be doing at 21. I did not go to journalism school like most people who are content professionals now. I have a political science degree from Ohio State, and my first job was with Teach for America. I'm teaching fourth grade in New Orleans. And I don't know if any of your listeners might be considering that program. That's something maybe we could talk about later, but I don't mind sharing that I was completely unprepared for anything that experience would have been as somebody who grew up in a tiny town in Ohio to now suddenly go to post-Katrina New Orleans. But teaching fourth grade in that environment was a great, a great way to kind of frame how stressful reporting actually is, because there's nothing a coach or an AD can say to me that a fourth grader hasn't said in more colorful language much earlier in my career. That kind of resets, like, oh no, chart beat's bad. Like, that's terrible. Did my classroom flood and snakes show up? Like, no. Okay. So like that's actually bad. This isn't that big of a deal. So I did that for a little while, realized I wasn't a particularly good teacher. I did political organizing for a little bit. And I had the misfortune of being a Democratic field organizer during the first Tea Party election. And I was working in rural Indiana, so you can imagine how that might have gone. At that point, I realized, you know, I don't think I want to work in politics. I don't think I want to go to law school like everyone else with a poli-sci degree. I think I want to try writing. But, you know, I graduated right when the last recession hit. So, mm-hmm. And there were no jobs. So I ended up doing a bunch of HR gigs and then writing at night. I would go cover high school sports. I'd be a stringer. I did some freelancing, and I did that for 3 years. And right as I was about to quit and go get an MBA, Vox Media hired me for SB Nation as a full-time role, as a hybrid editorial and training and business management role for their college programming. And I ended up being there for 7 years, learned how to be a reporter, learned how to run a little media business, and eventually kind of rose up the ranks there to overseeing all of their college programming. But then in April of 2020, the world ended, right? This is when the pandemic really kind of kicked into high gear, and Vox for a while was moving away from sports. They wanted to double down more on a kind of 95 corridor cultural political programming and video programming. And this gave them a kind of an excuse to do something that they wanted to do ahead of time. So they laid almost everybody off. And I hear all these stories of these entrepreneurs that like start businesses because they want to throw off the yoke of their editors, right? Or they want to deliver the unfiltered truth, or they felt spiritually called to be an entrepreneur. And I don't mind telling anybody, I was not that person. I did this because I felt like I had no other choice. In 2020, I'm not a 23-year-old blogger anymore. I'm in my early 30s. I'm married. I have two small children. I have a mortgage. I'm settled in Chicago. And I'm like, I can't move to Brooklyn for 44 grand a year to do the BuzzFeed blogger life anymore. Like, that's I'm not at that stage in my life. And when the pandemic, the Sun Times isn't hiring, the Tribune's not hiring, NPR's not hiring, PR isn't even hiring. So I launched Extra Points literally because the alternative was me working at the deli counter and taking some kind of completely different role just to put food on the table. And I figured this is my chance to write about some of the things that I'm deeply interested in that won't play very well in a page view focused environment, to get into really niche college athletic stories, to kind of merge my background in education and in politics and in policy with this world that I know really well in college athletics. And I was extremely blessed that a market for that took off much faster than I had expected. Within a year, it had grown enough where I didn't need to go get another job and other entities were interested in buying me out. And a little over a year, I sold it to D1 Ticker, who's a B2B company that works for the college athletics industry. And now I work with them and write for people that work in college athletics. I write for students, like many of the people who might be listening to this audience. And then a surprisingly large number of people that don't work in the industry at all. They're just diehard fans. They're the kind of people that I'm like, hey, would you like to learn about how Ball State sells basketball tickets? They're like, yes, and by God. Those people are gigantic nerds, and I'm so glad that they exist, and I'm so glad that we have a format here where I can serve their needs.
Absolutely. So a couple of things. I want to go back and talk a little bit about your time with Teach for America. So I did see that you taught fourth grade. A fun fact is that I applied for Teach for America in New Orleans, but ended up taking a job at the University of Memphis. So we almost might have had a similar experience there, although this would have been it would have been post-Katrina, but a few years later. So I don't know that I would have had the flooding classroom and the snakes and maybe some of the stuff that you ran into. But tell me a little bit about, I mean, what prompted you to apply for Teach for America and go to New Orleans for that experience?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So, you know, it's funny. I have this very gringo name, right? My name is Matt Brown, but my mother, her name is Maria Regina Figueiredo, and she moved to this country from Brazil. As part of her story, she ended up getting her bachelor's degree in her late 20s after she had already gotten married and had all of her kids, and then just never stopped. And then ended up eventually getting a PhD and was working after teaching in middle school for a long time, and then would work to as part of her doctorate program to train principals. So talking about education and educational equity and educational policy was part of dinner table conversations my entire life. And okay. I thought as a kid, I kind of wanted to be like her. I'm like, I'm going to go work in ed policy. I'm going to go maybe go to law school, go save the world and do all these things. And maybe to do that first, I'll join TFA. And it's funny, like, and I graduated high school in 2005 and talking about Teach for America in my undergrad years, it was the conversation there was more about using Teach for America to address staffing shortages and social capital problems. And it wasn't until I got to New Orleans who I kind of picked out of a hat. I'm like, I like jazz music and I want to get into this program. And this is the biggest cohort. I didn't realize that I had no idea about the union busting politics of Teach for America at this point. And when I walk into that building, like the last thing we need is a white looking dude from the north to come in here to break the, I'm like, I had no idea. I'm so sorry. Like now I understand why nobody wants to talk to me in the building. And didn't understand really how what I was doing fit into this larger ecosystem. I came in with positive intentions and had to learn a lot very quickly. You can teach a bright person, I think, how to backwards lesson plan in 5 weeks, and you can learn some of the very basics of classroom management, but there is nothing that will prepare you culturally. There's nothing that will prepare you for the amount of trauma that those students might have. I think I was the only male in our building male instructor in that building. And I was 23. I had barely lived in a big city, and Columbus was like the big city I had lived in. Right. So that was very much a drinking from a fire hose kind of moment.
Wow. That sounds like maybe an experience that set you up, as you mentioned, for what you would, kind of face later in your career with some of the stuff you're dealing with now. So somewhere along the way, you mentioned, obviously, you pivot to founding Extra Points. So I want to talk about maybe for any listeners who aren't familiar with Extra Points, let's kind of start there and have you explain that.
Sure. So Extra Points is a newsletter, publishes 4 days a week, that seeks to cover the off-the-field forces that shape college athletics. So it's a sports newsletter that isn't really about who's going to win the Big Ten. It's not going to break down recruiting decisions. It's not going to give you a game preview or anything. But I wanted to write about educational, policy, political, and business stories that shape this industry. So you know, as an example, something that I'd been curious about for a while that I think gets misconstrued a little bit in national coverage are why a lot of smaller Division I schools have pretty robust athletic departments, even though they don't generate a lot of earned revenue, right? There's not a lot of people going to watch Youngstown State basketball. There's not a lot of people going to watch baseball at Eastern Illinois or anything at Sacramento State or some of these tuition-dependent private schools. But you talk to the administrators there, and they say, like, we do these as ways to recruit and retain students. They're about tuition. They're about enrollment management, all these other things that may not show up on an FRS report or the USA Today Athletic Department database. And that's the kind of thing that I want to talk about, or about how population demographic shifts change recruiting patterns, about how the name, image, and likeness world works, or political bills work. And my experience, a lot of these things aren't covered in a lot of depth nationally or locally. And that's not because the local reporters are not capable. But if you are a Memphis beat writer, for example, you're going to be you got to go to the press conferences. You got to go to practice. You got to go talk to the Christian Brothers high school coach to follow up on the kid that might commit to Memphis. You got to use all these other things. You don't have time, and your newspaper doesn't support you to go to the State House and figure out what's happening with Tennessee NIL. So my bid is, let me focus on all of that stuff so you can focus just on what's happening within like your specific locality and try to serve the reader that way.
How, my question simply is, how do you do that, right? Like, how do you find the information that you need to be able to fill a newsletter with that information for like cross country? Because it's not like you're just focusing on one state individually. You're focusing very broadly on, you know, the whole country and sports as it looks that way.
Yeah. And that could be a little bit overwhelming because it's a big beat, right? We have 360 schools just in Division I. And I will occasionally write about D2, D3, NAIA, and other things. So of course, as one guy with a relatively small staff now at D1 Ticker, I can't do everything. You know, part of this comes from the fact that I've been writing about sports long enough that I do have a source network, right? I know a lot of athletic directors, I know agents, I know marketing firms, and the consultants and kind of the greater industrial complex in this industry, so that I have people I can talk to. You do this for a while, you get PR pitches, you build tweet deck searches, and I have Google alerts for some other things. And I rely pretty heavily on my colleagues who produce the Ticker newsletters. So, and I think anybody that's interested at all in college athletics would benefit from reading D1 Ticker, which is free, and it's just a clipping service. And so I have coworkers that do nothing but like scrape all of the local papers throughout the country to see if somebody gave an interview about their budget for some tiny Division I school. And I can scrape those and then figure out, okay, what, and then I have like a big Trello board. What do I need to make phone calls for? What can I follow up? And it ends up being a mix. So there's a decent amount of original reporting in Extra Points. I break some stories, but like my value prop to my readers is not that I'm a newsbreaker like Nicole Auerbach or Pete Thamel or Brett McMurphy are, because I don't have that support infrastructure, but I can analyze and advance and curate and demonstrate and explain some of these forces in a new way.
I gotcha. So at some point you sell to D1 Ticker. Did they seek you out? D1 Ticker has been around for a little while now. Yeah, I don't know how many years, but yeah. Did you find them? Did they find you? How did that work?
Yeah. So this was, I wouldn't say that starting a business in the middle of the pandemic was lucky. in many ways, it was extraordinarily unlucky, in part because like I'm in Chicago. Chicago Public Schools mostly closed. Yeah. So like I'm like talking to a source event. My daughter's teaching, doing first grade in the other room. I'm like, excuse me, I got to go help her with like subtraction and then come back. And that was a huge mess. But because of when I started, it meant that I had a head start uncovering name, image, and likeness. I developed reporting relationships with the lawmakers that created most of those pioneering bills in California and Florida and Colorado and across the country. And because I was kind of the perfect writer to really get into that world, because at SB Nation, I sold ads. I was part of crafting ad packages and doing business development for them. And a lot of influencer marketing, which is the cornerstone of NIL, is about selling ads. So like, I understood CPM, I understood, you know, brand and publisher fit, I think a little bit better than some other reporters who never had to do any of those things. So I don't like using the word expert, because that field has changed so quickly, but I was one of the earlier people to write about this in a deep way. And I think a lot of larger publishers 6 months into NIL realized it might be cheaper just to buy Matt or hire Matt, who already now has an audience and is seen as a voice in this world, right, than for us to cultivate that expertise ourselves. And so a year in, I signaled that I would like to sell. And it wasn't because I wanted a gigantic bag of money, although if someone wanted to give me one, that'd be great. It was more of realizing, and this is a problem with being an entrepreneur, I'm not good at everything. I'm a pretty good reporter, pretty good writer, and I have more experience in ad development, but I don't know anything about publishing tech stacks. I didn't know anything about Google ads or Facebook ads or some of this growth marketing stuff. And I also recognized I wanted to write, I wanted to make this a good business, and I wanted to be an engaged father and a good husband. So like, I got to sell to somebody who has some of these skills so I can grow this, because it isn't just me. I can't do it alone. And my background at NIL and that timing led to a lot of interest. I ended up selling to D1 Ticker, not because they had the high bid, they actually didn't by a long shot, but because I trusted their management. I felt aligned with their entire company and thought this is going to elevate the value of my work. There were gambling companies, or there were some consultancies or non-publishers that just looked at needing to get a foothold into this industry and were willing to pay more money. But I felt like that wasn't really lined up with what I wanted to be doing.
So, and D1 Ticker, I think you mentioned this at the beginning, it's sometimes multiple times a day. I was going to say it's a daily email, but sometimes multiple times a day, depending on when there's breaking news. Yep. So for those who are not aware, they're also, to my knowledge, is a D2 ticker, D3 ticker.
Yeah, there's, okay. So it's actually several publications. So the core publication, you're right, D1 Ticker publishes twice a day, one in the morning and one at the end of the business day. It's straight clipping. So there's no original content. It's just, here's a list of every single major college story that happened today. This was a pretty common business strategy before the internet really blew up, right? Like people would subscribe to like the AP Wire or the UPI or everything to get these clips. And I would say almost every single athletic director and Division I and most senior personnel and most senior industry people read this newsletter. It's free. It's ad supported. They have a version of it for Division II, III, and NAIA. That doesn't come out every day because there's not as much news.
Sure.
It comes out a couple of times a week. And then there are sister publications that are smaller for like evergreen thought leadership. You know, if you wanted, you know, you might pay to read an interview from an AD talking to another AD about DEI or about, you know, hiring best practices or some of the struggles unique to that world. And I kind of fit in as original content and someone that's seeking to reach people at a different part of that funnel than what they had before.
I gotcha. So, and now Extra Points still exists as the newsletter kind of alongside, is it fair to say, or separate from D1 Ticker? It's not like it comes out in the same email. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I would say it's a sister publication. So gotcha. D1 Ticker might reference something I write in EP and the money goes to the same place, but we're reaching slightly different audiences and having different takes, right? So D1 Ticker might say, here's the story from the Sacramento Bee. And then Extra Points that afternoon might say, like, here's the analysis of that story from the Sacramento Bee. And I called up two people in Sacramento to advance that story a little bit. Here's some jokes here's some different quotes about that thing. And advancing it. And that's kind of what we're hoping to do here.
I gotcha. Adding some flavor to the stories, if you will.
Yeah. And moving it along, right? Because I think it can be, it's, there's a lot of newsletters and a lot of media companies whose value that they're trying to add is just in curation. And I think that that's much harder to do in the internet in 2023 than it might have been in 2015. And so for me, if I'm going to do any curation, I feel like I have to add something, which literally means like make a phone call, do some reporting, file an open records request, share some data, or because I've been on this beat for so long, I can add analysis or context or connect it to something that chatbot can't do, or a 22-year-old who's just got on the beat can't necessarily do. Otherwise, I'd get swallowed up. And I think for anybody else that's curious about starting something in the content space, if you can't write something original every time, which is a tall order for anybody, mm-hmm. I think you kind of have to look at curation plus and add that value. Otherwise, it's really hard to build a connected audience. Absolutely. I would not have a business if I didn't have an audience rather than just page views.
Right, right. And do you feel like that, I mean, do you feel like you had that audience built at least partially at the time that you started Extra Points because of the connections and things you had already?
You know, a little bit, but the running joke that I would use is I wasn't even the most famous Matt Brown writing about college football because I have my evil twin at The Athletic who's like about okay. my same age. She's the same, right? I should have gone by like Matt Figueredo when I had the chance, but now it's too late.
Yeah.
I had a little bit. I want to say I had maybe 1,000 free subscribers when I turned on the paywall, but and that head start really did help, but it didn't really kick into high gear until I started making this my full-time job.
I gotcha. Okay. Gosh, what a path.
I got lucky.
Well, it maybe, and what you said, starting a business in the pandemic is, I mean, I don't know that you would find somebody else who said, I got lucky starting a business in the pandemic, but yeah. It's an interesting kind of pathway to where you are today.
Yeah, no, it is true. And I think about this a lot, honestly, because you're right. Like on one hand, like that timing was horrific, right? This was the civil society was crumbling and this was not the easiest time to dedicate all of this time to building a business. But I know I had a severance package when I got laid off. I had some savings. And even though I was responsible for helping with you know, both kids during the day, I also have a really supportive spouse and an infrastructure to help with some of those things. And I think it's important for me to be really conscious about acknowledging those things because mm-hmm. not every entrepreneur, you know, if I was a single dad, for example, I don't know if Extra Points would have necessarily existed or if I was by myself.
Right.
Like for a while, I even had my wife like listed in the about page. I'm like, she did a lot of stuff to make this happen between copy editing occasionally or putting the kids to bed so I could do an interview. And that's, I think that is part of the entrepreneurial journey. It would be unfair for me to say I did this completely alone.
Yep. Yep. For sure. It's always, I mean, it's maybe one of the biggest myths, right? That when you're an entrepreneur, you're doing everything by yourself because you do have to have that established network there to begin with, to be able to get something to take off for sure.
I think so.
So two things. Number one, your mention of your kids just reminded me that at some point during the pandemic, I want to say maybe your daughter got a hold of your phone and was tweeting out some things.
Oh my gosh. Let me tell this story. So it's funny. I will never be able to get a job in the State Department or the CIA because my device management skills are pretty terrible. But when my oldest was first born, and we were living in a tiny one-room apartment in Washington, D.C., or just outside of Washington, D.C., very early in my career. My daughter, Penelope, would do this sometimes. And, you know, my laptop would be open to TweetDeck, and the little kids, as they're learning to walk, they'll just hammer things. So occasionally you'd see, like, the gibberish tweets. And that became a running joke for some of my followers in the very beginning. You know, whenever there's a pocket tweet, and people are like, Penny, no. But now my daughter is 8. And she's learned not just how to type in complete sentences, but this is terrible. She's learned that it's funny and that she could get an immediate response. And so there was a time, about a year and a half, and both of my girls are home. And I was taking a call. I'll always remember this. It was the conference commissioner. It was like a serious reporting call. And because I pace when I'm on the phone, I took it in the backyard. And while I was in the backyard, my 8-year-old went downstairs, pulled up TweetDeck, and began tweeting about how she was being attacked by fart monsters. And there was a long thread about farts. And, you know, I come back and I'm like, why does my phone have like 326 messages and notifications? And it was just, and thankfully, people thought it was funny. Like I was getting texts from like other ADs and everything. And it got to the point, like it became such a joke. You won't be able to see this on camera. We made fart monster stickers.
I love
it. We sent out to paid subscribers. It became like a running bit. And I paid my daughter $2 every time we sold one of them as a commission. And then also said like, but seriously, you can't do this anymore.
Right.
Yeah. It's funny, but I don't mind sharing this. Like I also recognize that I think I get a little bit more grace for this because I'm a guy, and the standard expectations of me as a father, I think, are a little bit different than there would be for a woman. And I, and whether that's one of my kids crashing a Zoom call or wandering into a television appearance, I've never been penalized for that. And I don't think that would be the case for everybody. And it's not something I'm doing on purpose, but that's, you know, my readers, for good or for ill, know that I'm a real person that has other things going on.
Yeah. I appreciate your acknowledgement of that, because I do think there are, I mean, we know just generally there are double standards for men and women who are working in sport, but I do think, to your point, you know, being able to build an audience and to have that human element in that connection with your audience, you know, makes people more invested for whatever reason. They kind of feel like they, you know, have a better sense of who you are, or they know you, or, you know, if they were to run into you somewhere, they could grab a beer with you and talk sports or whatever it is. So,
and honestly, I think this is an extremely important thing for anybody that's looking to build something into the content world, right? So for a student, I think it's important to realize, like for this newsletter, I have 15,000 or so total subscribers. I don't make very much money on the free ones. I sell ads, but that's only about 10% of our revenue. The bulk of the revenue comes from paid subscriptions. And you're converting somewhere between 6 and 10% of engaged free people to paid. It's very difficult to beat that ratio. And what surprised me as I began to get audience intelligence about why people were subscribing or why they were staying, it wasn't just because I might break a story about where Murray State's going to play basketball next year or about the NIL industry. A surprising number of people said, I'm invested in you. I like reading you. Mm-hmm. And what, for good or for ill, unfortunately, like I only learned how to write how I talk because I didn't go to Northwestern business, you know, journalism school and have these other things beat into me. And there are times when I'll sit down at the keyboard and like, I'm just going to crack my heart open and bleed a little bit on here, right? So if I'm feeling overwhelmed or beaten down by the dishonesty in this world or the futility in writing right after the shooting in Texas happened at the elementary school, and I heard about this as I was taking my daughters back from school, and I was just like, writing about NIL feels stupid right now because of these things.
Right.
I don't think I could do that if I was working for the Associated Press. And I recognize that voice and approach isn't for everybody. And rarely, but occasionally somebody will say like, I'm doing this just as a transactional thing. It's not for me. But overwhelmingly, if I go to a conference, if I go to the NCAA convention or reach out, people will say like, I feel like I know you. And I know that even if I don't agree with everything you're saying, that you're coming by it authentically and honestly. And that's built a strong relationship that way. And it's not just, not only do I think that that's critical for building a content related business, as much as I roll my eyes when I hear about people talking about personal brands and everything, like, but that's what this means in real life. And part of that is saying like, I'm not gonna sit here and make my newsletter therapy, but you know, my readers know I have kids. They know my general political affiliation. They know my religious affiliation. They know how I feel about things. And I try to do that tastefully, but that was how I made this work. It was by really giving myself to my audience.
Yeah. For sure. And that shows again, just based on what you've said, where you have, you know, not only the following through your actual newsletter, but even from a media, social media standpoint and some of the grace you get there when your daughter does hijack that too. So
yeah,
that's awesome. Lucky. Okay. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit into kind of the final phase of the show. And the question I'm going to ask you now is, what is one experience or maybe even a series of experiences that you've had that you feel has helped you to bloom into the person you are today?
You know, that's a good one. Let me think about that for a second. We talked about this a little bit in my early career. You know, one professional experience that I haven't shared which I legitimately do think has been foundational for how I work as a reporter, was when I was in college, as is common for other people that share my faith tradition, I went on a, I served an LDS mission, right? So I put on the name tag, I got the bike, I did the whole door knocking thing, and I went to Sacramento, while many of my compatriots go to more exotic places in the world. I went to suburban California. And that's a very difficult thing to ask of a 19-year-old who has no life experience, but that entire job is trying to talk to people who do not want to talk to you about, you know, and kind of bare your heart a little bit. And the one thing that I think I picked up from this was you had to have a thick skin, because people don't want to talk to strangers about Jesus. And I understand that. Like, if Jehovah's Witnesses come to my door, I don't always invite them in, as right. much as a hypocrite as that might make me be. And that's a really important skill for a writer. Or for anybody that's a reporter, because a lot of what you're trying to do is talk to people that don't want to talk to you. And you have to recognize, not take that personally, and meet people where they are and try to build that connection. And while I'm sure I missed on important writing tips, and I came to some reporting skills and learned about FOIA a little bit later in my career, and I'm maybe a little bit older than maybe some of my other, you know, other peers of my level of experience. If your formative jobs are trying to talk to people about Jesus on the street, talk to people on the street about Social Security and Democratic candidates, and then talk to some fourth graders as a mostly white guy from Ohio about multiplication, and absolutely none of those people want anything to do with you, there's nothing that Urban Meyer or Greg Sankey or any NIL agent can say that I haven't already heard. And that's not a bad experience, I think, to have coming into your first reporting jobs. I think I came in there, I don't want to say worldly, but with some very different and useful experience coming into this world that I don't think I would have gotten had I just been covering high school football in Oklahoma as a 22-year-old, you know?
Yep. I love it. That's good stuff. Okay. This is the lightning round that I referred to earlier. We also have called it the quick peel, because, you know, onion, the slap chop round was in there as well.
Hopefully this doesn't make me cry.
Well done. All right. So I've got 5 questions here. A couple of them they might not be super quick answers, but we can kind of roll through them. So
I'll do my best.
The first one, what has been the most interesting story that you've ever covered?
Most interesting. I'm going to be forgetting a couple of them here, but, you know, as a way to show it that this kind of took me in places I wasn't really expecting. My first football game that I covered after the pandemic, first in-person event, was a UConn-UMass football game. And for those that are not aware, those two teams suck. They were, I think, combined winless. It was the two worst teams in college football. The weather wasn't very good. And the student body at UMass has a rude name for this game that I can't say on the air. I was easily the only national media person there. And it was one of the only games that I've covered where, like, the students and the staff thanked me for being there, because my whole thing was, I'm not here to make fun of you. I'm here to understand why 25,000 of you are here when it's 45 degrees to watch garbage football. And I promise to take you seriously. Right. And that's not the experience I typically get as a reporter, you know, dressed in my tweed jacket and my, you know, extremely sports writer outfit. And people be like putting their arm around me and saying, like, I want to show you why I'm in Amherst, Massachusetts right now, and why this is important to me. And it ended up being one of the most important things that I ever wrote. And I'm so glad that I went. And that was honestly an important reminder to me, after being away for a year and a half, about why I like being there and at this event, even though the game itself was truly putrid.
Yeah, that's awesome. Sounds like a very interesting one indeed.
It was fun.
Second question, who is your favorite musician or musical group?
This is really basic as a reporter, but like I love Bruce Springsteen. I love the band. I love dad music. I know that the worst sports writers in the world all love this guy, but my parents loved him. And there's something about a band with like 26 musicians in the back that kind of speaks to me. I love that stuff.
I got to ask now, because I just listened to a podcast episode the other day where they were debating Bruce Springsteen and Bob Seger. And somebody had mentioned that Bob Seger is the Bruce Springsteen of the Midwest. So I got to ask if you also like Bob Seger.
I do like Bob Seger. And it's so funny because one of the cool things about having really little kids is that you can mold their taste a little bit. So like my four-year-old loves Bob Seger. She's like, play the rock and roll song again, you know, and Bob Seger looks a little bit like my dad looked. And, okay. And I would say Seger is the Michigan Bruce Springsteen. Yeah. Indiana Bruce Springsteen would be John Mellencamp. And I think different parts of the Midwest have different ones, but there's a lot, absolutely a lot of similarity.
Yep. The guy that mentioned that was from Detroit. So that checks out.
Yeah. There you go.
Awesome. What has been your favorite, like, what's your favorite sport to cover?
I love covering football, and part of that is because it is orderly enough and there's enough breaks in the action that it can be tracked a little bit easier. Like if I get up and go to the bathroom in a basketball game, I'm going to miss six plays. And it's football, I think, because it's made for television and made for writers, it's a little bit easier to digest. I will say one other one though, that's really underrated, that is a delight to cover, is women's volleyball. I think a lot of maybe students and football fans don't realize, one, how well attended it is, how explosively athletic it is, how intense it is. And it's a very different crowd. The couple of times I've done this at Big Ten events, and the crowd is full, but it's mostly like 10-year-old girls. And this is not a pejorative thing at all. That's a different kind of energy than like drunk dads. Right. And it's really cool. Like I think everybody should go. If you're in an SEC or a Big Ten market, you should go to some volleyball games.
Definitely. You got to check it out with no bias coming from me, but to say, obviously check out Illinois volleyball if you're going to go Big Ten.
they're great. They're great too. That's a tough league, but they have some great players there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I guess I'll also throw in now Ohio State, because one of my former assistant coaches is the head coach at Ohio State. So I'd be remiss if I didn't also mention checking out Ohio State volleyball. Okay. Last one here before I get to the fill in the blank. So, this is not a short one probably, but what is your prediction for the future of college sports?
Well, that's an hour long episode right there.
If you had a like two or three sentence, summation.
The biggest thing is we are moving towards an employee model. The question to me is not whether we will, or it's going to be which employees are part of that model, and whether the NCAA or Congress or the courts will take the lead in shaping that. And I am deeply convinced this is happening, whether it's through the Johnson case or House or the NLRB or Congress itself moving forward. And a lot of the hair pulling debate about NIL or about some of these other things, it's going to be really moot in 3 years when the infrastructure supporting college athletics looks extremely different.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, fill in the blank. Okay. Blooming is blank.
Blooming is? Delicious, I guess. I'm still thinking of the onion, right? We were joking about this beforehand, but I worked with Ryan Nanny. Like I worked with the original Bloomin' Onion guy. And so when I hear that, I still think of Outback. Like it's good branding.
I love it. We've had a lot of different answers to that. And we also, I switched for a while and I was doing onions are blank. But we've had a lot of different answers across the board. I don't know that we've had delicious just yet.
Yeah, I mean, like you can't eat the whole thing because you'll have a heart attack. It's like 2,400 calories, but
you got to share it. You got to share it. It's pretty good. Sure.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Well, Matt, thank you so much for taking the time to join me here today. It's great to, as I mentioned initially, knock the dust off and round out season four here. But it's been also great to hear about all the great things that you've been doing and what's happening now with Extra Points and D1 Ticker and everything else, Fart Monsters and all the above.
it's been my pleasure. I'll end with this quick note. I am really passionate about trying to help other people start similar businesses. As much as I care about college athletics, I deeply believe that starting things, I think similar to what, how Extra Points works, is going to make a better internet, to move away from algorithms and writing things that people want to read. So if you're listening to this and you have an idea of your own, or you want to talk through this in more detail, I'm at matt@extrapointsmb.com. Feel free to drop me a note. I promise I'll respond.
I love it. I love it. Awesome. We're making connections, moving forward. Thanks again, Matt. It's been great to have you.
Nope. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.